morning. Daniel Browning filling in for Michael Cathcart, who's taking a short break this week. Welcome to Books and Arts on RN, on podcast, or on your ABC radio app. And today, a novel that outgrits the grittiest version of New York you could ever imagine. Characters are displaced, alienated, pounding the pavements of poverty. And they're in love. Atticus Lish joins us with his novel, Preparation for the Next Life.
I think there were three main things pushing me. First, I was upset over the Iraq War. Second, I took a trip to China, and that left a mighty impression on me. And then the third thing was I moved to New York. So those three came together, and that's where this book came from.
And marriage, ghosts, and a lot of pears. We meet the team behind a new production of the Noel Coward classic Blithe Spirit, which opens in Perth this week.
I feel like it's very common for our relationships to be haunted by the relationships that happened before them. Not in a sense that you're still hanging out with your ex, which, you know, is the kind of comedy of the play, but the sense that everything that happens in a relationship is affected by the relationship that you had before.
But first, a new performance work about the space between us, the weight of history and the personal, in Robin Latham's The Aborigine Is Present. That's Lady Gaga, believe it or not, practicing the Abramovich method. And why? It'll soon become clear. Now on Books and Arts, the artist Robin Latham. Robin has created a work called The Aborigine Is Present. Now, it's based on a famous work by the world-renowned performance artist Marina Abramovich, a work called The Artist Is Present, where Abramovich sat opposite an individual member of the public and where she held their gaze for 3 months. Not the same guest, obviously a number of people over 3 months. But the focus of Robin Latham's new work is not one artist, but a cast of Aboriginal people. Robin Latham, welcome to Books and Arts.
Good morning.
First of all, what does this work consist of? It's in the same way that The Artist Is Present, Abramovich's famous work, two people sat opposite each other. Mm-hmm. But tell us, there's more to it than that.
It's certainly springboards from Marina's work, and the setup is there's a simple wooden table and two chairs, and we begin the performance with the clap of the clapsticks three times, and then an Aboriginal person or a Torres Strait Islander person comes out, sits down in the chair and closes their eyes. When they're settled, the non-Aboriginal person comes across and sits opposite them. When the Aboriginal person's ready, they open their eyes and look at the other person for 5 minutes.
And where does the idea, not just, it doesn't just come from Abramovich. I mean, there's something deeper at play when you bring an Aboriginal person with their history and a non-Aboriginal person with their history, wherever they might be from, when you bring those two people together to face to face. What do you think happens there?
I can only talk about what happens for me in that space, because every single person who comes and meets, it's a meeting between those two people.
Between individuals,
yeah. Two people bring. So every performance is unique, and every sitting with every couple is unique to what those two people bring. The background to this performance is around consciousness raising. I'm really interested in consciousness raising art practice. And it seems to me that non-Indigenous Australia carries a lot of shame, blame, guilt, and a lot of unconscious baggage as well about what's happened to our First Nations people in Australia. And in many ways, what do we do with that? Where do we go with that? And certainly it's not about thought. So to remove the capacity to speak removes a lot of the interference of thought and logic. So once you remove that, people simply look at each other, then it just reduces the difference.
So things open up. I know that I'm talking to Abramovich's collaborator, Lindsay Peisinger, who choreographed a work she did in Sydney very recently. And she kept talking about, and I hate to say this, but she talked about this energetic field that is generated between two people when they're sat in this kind of white cube and all these eyes are upon them. Mm. And let's face it, Abramovich's work is... it's like going to see a rock concert, you know. Mm. She's that version of that kind of person in the art world. Mm. But I guess, you know, there's so much focus on what happens, the energetic field. Mm. Did you find that too in conceptualizing this performance? Was that something you wanted to tease out?
People in the space, when we've sat over the last 2 weekends at the Koori Heritage Trust, the new location of the Koori Heritage Trust.
In Federation Square in Melbourne.
At Fed Square. Mm. I was very concentrated on holding the space with my stage manager, Naretha Williams. So we were very focused on that. But people did say the energy of the performances was palpable once you walked past the entrance and into the gallery mm-hmm. space. So you have the people observing the people who are watching each other.
And that must be pretty powerful. I mean, for them, what are people saying to you? You are getting a lot of reaction from members of the public who participate in the Aborigines President the Aborigines present in Fed Square, and like Abramovich's performances, a lot of it is based on what she hears back from people.
Yes,
the power of the performance is not in what Abramovich does. It's the kind of reactions that she talks about, the public becoming the performing body.
Yes, and one of the very interesting and lovely things that Deborah Cheatham said in her opening speech of the Aborigines Present, she said, "I've done a lot of performance in my life, but I've never become the artwork." And she said she was actually quite nervous about being the artwork. But if you want, I can read an email that I received from
Please,
a lovely,
yes.
lovely woman. And I'll de-identify the person, but she says, "Hi, Robin. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for allowing me to sit in the Aborigines Present. It was such an amazing and indescribable experience. I've never felt so much love and support from a stranger. This performance has given me much confidence and filled me with a kind of pride I haven't felt before. Congratulations on putting together such an incredible body of art. Thank you, Robin, for an experience I'll never forget."
And that's exactly the kind of tone of a lot of... I mean, I haven't seen the negative responses from members of the public to Abramovich's work. She, you know, publishes only the relatively positive. I do remember, and I said this to you off air, was that one of the people who saw 512 Hours, the show she did at the Barbican in London last year, very much similar work, mm-hmm. durational, over long periods of time, people sat opposite each other, interacting. Mm. But this person said that it was like rehab, but better.
Yeah.
So there's this acknowledgement that some kind of, I hate to say it, but some kind of therapy occurs.
I think it depends on what every single person brings to it. One person may be unconsciously looking for one thing, another for another, and to simply look at another person and to go past the colour of the person, past into the soul, which is colourless, then that is going to be life-changing.
Yeah, and I said in the introduction, for me, it was about the space between us, all kinds of people, whoever we are. But I guess there is the weight of history, and there's all the other things that go along with being an Aboriginal person in Australia, and you and I can talk about that. Mm. We're actually reenacting the Aborigines Present, but it's two Aborigines talking to each other. But it might not be about the weight of history. It might be about just getting rid of that.
I think you've nailed it. I think you've absolutely nailed it. And it is about going beyond the guilt, blame, shame and persecution of... And I'm notwithstanding that there's a lot of transgenerational trauma within our communities across Australia, and at the same time too, I'm really interested in the space where these two fantastic knowledge systems that we have in Australia, our First Nations knowledge systems and our non-Indigenous knowledge systems, come together. And in that moment, I think there's a gestalt jump into something where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Mm.
And that's the potential of Australia, and that's the area I'm interested in.
Now, you're on Books and Arts. Daniel Browning here, filling in for Michael Cathcart. I'm with the artist Robin Latham. We're talking about a performance work being staged in Melbourne's Federation Square called The Aborigines Present. Now, Marina Abramović has given her blessing to this. When you approached her, what did Abramović, the world-renowned performance artist, have to say in response? I know that she's, over very many years, tried to cultivate a relationship with Aboriginal people.
Mm. Look, Daniel, I wrote to her and I found the only email address I could. And, you know, I thought, oh, here we go. I've got to ask her permission to do this, because this was originally held in 2014. Mm. And I didn't hear back for 3 weeks, and then I thought, oh, look, she's probably pretty busy. You know, I might write again. So I wrote again, and bingo,
she
the next
probably
day.
Probably in one of her durational performances somewhere in the Arctic, or who knows.
So she wrote back, and I can read, if you like, some of her email, some of which is on the wall at the exhibition space at the Trust. She said, your letter about the work you want to create touched me very deeply. I'm very honoured to be contacted by you, an Aboriginal woman, because living with Aborigines in Central Australia literally changed my life. She says, I was living there with my partner at the time, Ule, and living with those people really changed my approach to the concept of reality and my work. They lived completely in the present, in the real sense of the world, and the entire dreamtime stories were what was not they were not happening in the past or the future, but always happening in the here and now. She went on to say that that completely influenced her work, The Artist is Present.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she says it would, if you want to, it would be, in my point of view, some way to give back to that community, and I'm completely in support of the Aborigines Present.
It's fabulous, fabulous. Well, enough about Abramović, actually, because I'm very interested in your work, and I first encountered you. You were shortlisted for the Victorian Indigenous Art Award some years ago, and I'm thinking of your Koolamans. Mm. Talk about your practice, which is so interesting, and about you come to us from Yamaji country in Western Australia. You're Melbourne-based. Mm. But talk a little bit about your own work.
Mm-hmm.
We've had enough of Abramović.
You can never have enough of it. Look, I've been living here in Melbourne nearly 30 years. And and I've been working my art practice for four decades at least, along with other areas of work. I've worked in academia as well. But my art practice is, as I said, about consciousness raising. And the Koolaman that you mentioned, I've used the Koolaman symbol again and again to represent the stolen generations of Australia, in that a Koolaman is a vessel to carry food, nuts. It's also a cradle for newborn babies. So the work called The Empty Koolaman was about the empty cradle and the stolen generations of Australia. And I had a work up at Bundjalaka for almost a year called Empty Koolamans in Memoriam to the Stolen Generations.
Bundjalaka, of course, the our special space at Melbourne Museum, the space of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples at Melbourne Museum. You were making these Koolamans, I guess, they're a tribute to loss.
They witness the loss of the grief and loss of the families of the stolen generations, the mothers, fathers, sisters, the people who were left behind, the children who were not taken, the children who were taken, and the ongoing intergenerational ramification of trauma is an attachment theory is well documented and researched. And again, I've made copper wire Koolamans, some of them 2 metres long, from just every piece is soldered, one piece to the next. And some of them take 5 months to make.
Oh, Lord, that's hard. That's heavy going.
Yeah, yeah. So I work across a number of mediums. I tend to choose the medium that most suits what the work's about. So if I want to make something in bronze, I'll make it in bronze. And it doesn't matter to me what medium I use. I try and master that and employ the medium that is best for what I'm trying to say.
Mm, what about a kind of philosophy that underpins all your work? I mean, that's thinking about the Aborigines present, which you devised fairly quickly But then the Coolamans, which are, you know, you spend a long time on those. They're durational. But what's the philosophy that underpins them all? I mean, you're talking about Gestalt there. There's a lot of theory bubbling underneath. Yeah. I think
a lot of my more recent work stems from my master's in fine art, which was a research around ritual process and sacred space. So in researching what creates a space that has a sense of the sacred, I actually went to a number of sacred sites in Australia, and I went to Sri Lanka and looked at, because that's got the three big religions there for a long time, and looked at sacred spaces there and distilled down some elements that were always present. One of them being that often when you enter a sacred space, you have to bow your head. Mm-hmm. And that is very humbling. I also worked very consciously with two other things, one being bending time, which is really being in the here and now,
mm-hmm.
and the other, the Akashic field, earth, fire, water, air, and space.
Oh, we could talk for a very long time. Robin Latham, it's been a real pleasure, and I can't wait to either be part or be there for the next performance of The Aborigines Present. Robin, thanks for being my guest here on Books and Arts.
My pleasure. Thank you, Daniel.
And The Aborigines Present is on next weekend at Federation Square in Melbourne. In the Koorie Heritage Trust Museum, which has just reopened there at Fed Square. You'll find details on the Books and Arts website. And we'd love to know if you've taken part in this or any of Abramovich's work, for instance. Get in touch via Twitter. You can find us at RN Books and Arts or via the Books and Arts website. I'm Daniel Browning, and you're on RN on your ABC radio app. This is Books and Arts.
I'll be loving you always, with the love that's true, always. When the things you plan need a helping hand, I will understand, always, always.
Frank Sinatra, of course, and his rendition of the Irving Berlin standard, Always. The song has special significance in Noel Coward's classic play, Blithe Spirit. It's played on the gramophone at the home of Charles and Ruth Condamine as a séance takes place. A séance which accidentally raises the spirit of Charles's former wife, Elvira. The show's been reworked countless times as a radio play, a movie, a television show, and even as a musical. Its latest incarnation will see Australian actress Roz Hammond take on the role of the eccentric medium Madame Arcati. The play is being staged in Perth by the Black Swan Theatre Company, and Claire Nichols is in rehearsals.
Will you all sit around the table, please, and place your hands downwards on it?
Come, Mrs. Bradman.
What about the lights?
All in good time, Mr. Condamine. Please, sit down, please. The fingers should be touching. That's right.
My name is Roz Hammond. I'm here for Blithe Spirit, and I'm playing Madame Arcati, who is the spiritualist who is invited to the Condamine House to perform a seance, which she does with devastating results.
Now, Blithe Spirit, it's been this hugely popular play right from its beginnings in 1941. How do you account for the enduring popularity of this show?
I think, you know, that there is an element of, you know, that idea that when you're in a relationship and things aren't going so well, sometimes you look back and think, oh, maybe that other one was better. And then if you had a chance to go back and revisit that other one to actually maybe find out that it wasn't better, that you're just looking at it through rose-coloured glasses. Also that idea of spiritualism, of bringing people back from the dead. I mean, that is always, you know, fodder and good interest of that, you know, because we want to make contact with people on the other side. So I think that keeps an element of interest in it as well, but also great dialogue, witty, funny, a marriage crumbling, you know, it's all there.
Yeah, because this play, it has Charles Condamine, his former wife Elvira, is summoned at this seance, and maybe it wasn't quite as good as he remembered it was.
Exactly, and actually she, she's very different to the current wife as well, and she creates all kinds of mischief. And of course the current wife is in a terrible situation because the ex-wife's in the house. I mean, how horrific.
I find it really interesting that this play was created back in 1941. We're talking the middle of World War II. And it's this very silly, fun play dealing with ghosts. Do you think, is it a brave play to create at that moment in history?
Yes, and I guess I think it's that kind of thing of going, all this, you know, terrible stuff's occurring. Let's take people away from that for this night in the theatre where you can forget all the bombs dropping around you and just have this, you know, frivolous fun.
I presume that is the gramophone, Mr. Condamine.
Yes, would you like me to start it? It's an electric one.
Please stay where you are. I can manage. Now, let me see. What have we here? Brahms. Oh, dear me. No. Rachmaninoff. Too florid. Where is the dance music?
They're the loose ones on the left.
I see.
I'm afraid they're none of them very new.
Daphne is really more attached to Irving Berlin than anyone else. She likes a tune she can hum. Ah, here's one. Always.
Do
sit down, Charles. About 10 years ago for the Melbourne Theatre Company and the Sydney Theatre Company, I played Ruth, who is the second wife. And so I do know the play quite well. But it's funny because you approach it so differently from each different character's point of view. So it sort of feels like a new play when you're playing a new character.
And it must be strange, though, sitting across from the actress playing Ruth and going, I know all your lines.
Yeah, they were coming back to me as she was saying them. I was thinking, oh, yeah. And then she says, yep. So, you know, it's really good fun.
Can you tell me a bit more about the character of Madame Arcati and how you're approaching her?
She's wonderful because she is this free spirit and she's very different to the others because the others are very sort of upper class and they're quite contained and quite moderate. And she's, you know, into the occult and cycles everywhere on her bike and is clearly a single woman in her, you know, late 40s. And so she's quite unusual and bohemian and free spirit. And of course gets to, you know, do all the wonderful kind of seancey kind of stuff. So great fun. I mean, it's a great comic role.
I must say I find bicycling very exhausting.
Steady rhythm. That's what counts. Once you get the knack of it, you need never look back. On you get and away you go.
But the hills, Madame Arcati, pushing up those awful hills.
Just knack again. Down with your head, up with your heart, and you're over the top like a flash and skimming down the other side like a dragonfly. This is the best dry martini I've had in years.
She's been played by some pretty formidable actresses in her time.
My word.
We've seen Angela Lansbury do this part, Miriam Margolyes, who I believe you got to witness her
play this role. Yes, so I played Ruth opposite her in that production, yes.
So what do you do then to kind of set yourself apart from these performances that you know quite intimately?
Well, I think the thing is, I am much younger than those two. Much. No.
yes, of
you know,
course.
So it is it will be obviously a younger interpretation. And physically, I'm very different from Miriam, who's sort of 4 foot nothing and, you know, force of nature. So I think I just have to abandon all the, you know, people who have gone before me and just really try and bring a fresh approach. And that's the great thing about Jeffrey J. Fowler is because he's a young, dynamic director. He had never read the play before being enlisted to do it and he'd never seen it. So that will help as well, that he has no preconception of what a Madame Arcati should be like.
Of course, I cannot guarantee that anything will happen at all. Daphne may be unavailable. She had a head cold very recently and was rather under the weather, poor child. On the other hand, a great many things might occur. One of you may have an emanation, for instance. Or we might contact a poltergeist, which would be extremely destructive and noisy.
I'm Jeffrey J. Fowler. I'm the Associate Director of Black Swan State Theatre Company and the Director of the upcoming production of Blythe Spirit. I've never seen it, and I had never read it last year. And Kate Cherry, who's the Artistic Director, was looking for something for me to direct, and it's a hard thing because I've come from a background in writing and directing my own work and devising new work, and I tend to make small independent shows that are, I guess, you know, savage black comedies, and Kate suggested Blythe Spirit. And at first I was like, oh, that's a really unusual choice for me. And I, to be really honest, wasn't at that point very familiar with Noel Coward even. I knew who he was and knew he was witty and had heard some great quotes. So I remember reading the play the first time and not being definite, but there being a few themes in it that kind of connected to. And then it was on the second read, and due to a few things I was going through at the time, I was like, oh no, there's a lot in this that I can relate to. And I think there's a lot in Blythe Spirit that a lot of people can relate to. It began an adventure, and I've slowly fallen in love with the piece and with the characters and what happens, which is that, yeah, we watch a man struggle with the fact that his past has come to haunt him. The feelings from the past have come to haunt him. And I think that's what the play is really about. And that's what my production will be about as well.
Take me back to that first reading of the play and those themes that jumped out at you. What were they?
Sure. I feel like it's very common for our relationships to be haunted by the relationships that happened before them. Not in a literal sense, not in a sense that you're still hanging out with your ex, which, you know, is the kind of comedy of the play, but the sense that everything that happens in a relationship is affected by the relationship that you had before. And like, I'm a pretty jealous guy. And I'm always really curious about my partner's exes. And also I feel like every partner I've been with has kind of left an imprint, an emotional imprint on me somehow, whether it's the kind of scars you get or the lessons you learn. And I don't know, I think the play deals with that in a really funny way. And I also think the play is about commitment and marriage. And in the 1940s, this was a play that was already examining the failures of monogamy and how difficult it can be to pledge yourself to someone permanently and the doubts within that. So I think even though the play is so old, I feel like it's actually really in line with a lot of debate going on right now.
Is there anyone there? One rap for yes, two raps for no. Now then, is there anyone there? Oh, shh! Is that you, Daphne? Is your cold better, dear? Oh, I'm sorry. Are you doing anything for it?
So, okay, traditionally in the play, the haunting works with a lot of stage trickery at the end. We're talking like flying vases and books launched across the stage and lamps turning on and off and pianos banging by themselves, which is great and really entertaining and, you know, means that Blythe Spirit is something that can't really be done on a small independent level. Like, you really need a proper set to do it. And I was kind of thinking, like, how can we look at a haunting beyond some kind of jolly, tongue-in-cheek 1940s stage tricks? And I think that is to represent the haunting in a kind of surreal, beautiful way where the space shapeshifts. And we've added elements in, for example, in the script, the character Charles off stage climbs a pear tree to try and get a pear. The branch of the pear tree breaks and he becomes injured. And we recognize this when he comes back in the stage. I was looking at what a pear means in Greek and Roman mythology. It was a symbol of immortality, which obviously has a lot of relevance to a play about ghosts. And in Chinese mythology, it's a symbol of divorce as well. And so we kind of took this image of the pear and we slowly have pear trees growing into the house across the course of the haunting, which for me was creating a visually sumptuous contemporary world that this old play would still exist within, and looking at how can you stage a haunting in 2015 as opposed to staging it in 1940s. In a traditional production, the ghosts are grey head to toe. So, you'd grey their skin and grey their hair and grey their costumes. And we've taken a very different avenue on the ghost as well, almost a Tim Burton circa 1992 kind of look, a big, surreal kind of caricature feel to them, which I hope can work within the world but give it a fresher edge for a younger audience and still, you know, please those people that are going to come because they love Noel Coward.
That was Jeffrey J. Fowler, the director of the Black Swan Theatre Company's production of Blythe Spirit, which opens in Perth on Saturday. Before that, actress Roz Hammond as Madame Arcati. Claire Nichols had that story. You're with Books and Arts on RN and on your ABC Radio app. I'm Daniel Browning, filling in this week for Michael Cathcart.
On the live set, the charisma and commanding stage presence of Dan Sultan.
We're going to try and have a good time tonight.
His most recent album, Blackbird, has picked up a bunch of awards, including an ARIA.
Now we doing this again.
A cracking set from Dan Sultan, live in Melbourne. That's the live set, online at the RN homepage.
Time now on Books and Arts for Top Shelf. Art historian Sasha Grishin was on the show last week talking about the colonial arts of S.T. Gill. Here's Sasha again, this time with a selection of his favourite works.
I'm Sasha Grishin, and this is my Top Shelf. I'm a visual person, basically a failed artist, and I've always been turned on by art, encounters, things that have happened to me. It's difficult, if you like, to have a list of half a dozen works, but the ones that sort of come floating in my mind are the things I'm working on currently. I'm working on a large exhibition of a colonial artist called S.T. Gill, who died in Melbourne on the steps of the GPO in 1880. And the one work which I think of Gill's is called Doing the Block, Great Collins Street, 1880. It's an absolutely gorgeous watercolour of a very fashionable strip in Collins Street between Elizabeth and Swanston Street, which was sort of the main shopping drag, but it's also the area for promenading. And Gill shows these people all dressed up in their finery, women and men with slightly hawkish looks. There's a newspaper boy that dashes across the scene. And when you just got everything set, Gill sums it all up with a little canine commentary. Two dogs in the foreground sniffing one another. Next on my top shelf was a chance encounter as a child with a print. I had walked into, literally off the street, into the National Gallery Victoria, and I wanted to find out something about a particular print, an obscure German printmaker, and I met this wonderful woman, Ursula Hoff. I was a child, and she took me aside and showed me a particular print by Albrecht Dürer. It basically was Death and the Devil. It was an image of a knight travelling through an enchanted landscape surrounded by the Death and the Devil, going to an absolutely unreachable pole. And when I looked at this, I remember tears came into my eyes. And I think that's the first time I ever experienced that when looking at an artwork. The next experience that I'll just share, it isn't actually an artwork, it's an exhibition. It was an exhibition of an artist I admired enormously called John Brack. It was a retrospective of his. I managed to sneak into the show before it actually opened to the public. And I was literally bawling my eyes out. It was a fantastic exhibition. And I didn't notice him at first, but tucked away in the columns was the artist, lurking. And I came up to him and gave him a big hug. And John's probably the most unhuggable person you could ever encounter. And after shaking me off him, he said, "You know, Sasha, when I go to one of my exhibitions, I always see 30, 40 mistakes. Now I see 30 or 40 years of them." And I realized that's how many great artists think about what they're actually doing. Also on my top shelf is this absolutely gorgeous sculptural work by Inga King. It's called Forward Surge. These are almost like black shells suspended in space as you walk down from the Flinders Street Station towards the entrance of the National Gallery of Victoria. And when I first saw it, what struck me was that the sculpture was actually inhabited. It had kids on skateboards whizzing around in it. And when I mentioned this to Inga, she said, "Oh, isn't it wonderful that my work is actually useful?" Because one of the definitions of art is that it's really an aesthetic object that has no practical function. And I was attracted to this idea of sculpture which actually interacts and plays with the public. And the final item for my top shelf is really more or less a story in my own life. When people ask, Well, how were you actually converted towards art? It was a rainy day. I was in Piccadilly in London. And I had a student pass, so you could actually get into Burlington House, the Royal Academy, free of charge after 4 o'clock. And I actually went there just to get out of the rain. And there was this exhibition of this bloke painting tonal still life compositions. I've never understood what it was about, but I know that when I walked out of that exhibition, there were tears in my eyes. I wasn't very clever. I'd never really had heard of Giorgio Morandi. But I realized that if you could actually make paintings that could actually reduce you to tears, there must be something special about that art form. And from that time on, I went for the 4 remaining days of that exhibition, being the first person in and the last person out. And in some ways, from then on, I was hooked.
And that was the top shelf of the art historian Sasha Grishin. Sasha's the man behind a gloriously illustrated book and a major exhibition, Australian Sketchbook, Colonial Life and the Art of S.T. Gill, which is on at the State Library of Victoria until the end of October. And if you think that music is relentless, you should feel the pace of the next novel on the Books and Arts bookshelf. It's a manic underworld of beauty and despair in the outer reaches of New York City. Writer Atticus Lish is an ex-soldier and mixed martial arts fighter. He's worked in a styrofoam factory and has also lived and worked in China. And all this grit and observation is pounded into the pages of his debut novel, Preparation for the Next Life. Atticus Lish spoke to Kate Evans from New York. Over to Kate.
Atticus Lish, I'm still reeling. Among other things, this is a love story that kicks you in the stomach and drags you over broken glass. What did you want to do with this novel?
Well, that's a great description, kicking somebody in the stomach and grabbing and dragging them over broken glass. And I wish I had thought of that. But now that you said it, that's exactly what I would like to do. First, to myself. That's why I wrote it, to have an effect on myself. And I'm honored that it had that effect on you.
Oh, look, so much. I was actually looking again this morning at some of the last section, and I had to stop reading it so that I could start thinking again and stop having just such a overwhelmingly emotional response to it.
I think that the best thing that I can get for myself out of art is to feel it, not to think it. So that's why one of my main inspirations is rock songs. I listen to a lot of AC/DC. When I set out to write this, I did try to tap into emotion first.
So where did it start then? What was it that you wanted to do?
I think there were 3 main things pushing me. First, I was upset over the Iraq War. Second, I took a trip to China. My wife Beth and I stayed a year in China and visited the Far West where the Uyghurs are, and that left a mighty impression on me. And then the third thing was I moved to New York and the impact of the city. So those 3 came together, and that's where this book came from.
Well, you can see all of those 3 elements in the novel, so perhaps we could break them down a bit. Tell us about Zolé. Who's she?
Zolé is a half Uyghur, half Han woman who is a person without a country, in my mind. She, on her father's side, she kind of harkens back to a China that is not really there anymore. If you look at China up until around 1990, people had a revolutionary way about them. They had a simplicity and an uprightness that has been and I'm talking as a type of style, as a sense of how you act, a kind of stoicism that has been replaced by commercial squalor. It's a wild new west out there. So in my mind, through her father, she's sort of like this old school revolutionary. That's how I pictured her, like somebody on one of those communist banners holding a flag. Then on her mother's side, I would say she traces her line back to mysticism, to Siberian shapeshifters. I wanted both of those things for her.
So she is an outsider in China and then an outsider again when she comes to America. What drives her to America?
What drives her to America is the economic difficulty and her loss of everyone in China, and also the fact that she's a migrant at heart. The Uyghurs, as I conceived of them, are a people who don't respect artificial political boundaries. I was inspired a little bit by a National Geographic article about Mongolians. It recently described how in Inner Mongolia, tribes people won't wait in line. They cut ahead of the city folk. They're independent. They're kind of like people from the American West or perhaps some of the people who settled in Australia. So she has a outward bound spirit, and that's part of what takes her to America.
What does the army mean to her?
The army means her father. The army means very differently from what it might mean to a person who's actually experienced war. The army means to her the construction of the country. It means working for the people.
Well, Skinner was in the army. Can you describe him?
Skinner is an ordinary person. That is the main thing that I wanted for him first above all, that he started ordinary. He wasn't meant to be a super soldier. He wasn't meant to be a brute or a thug. He was meant to be a regular guy from a regular place. And he, during his deployment, was crushed by what happened. He was driven into post-traumatic stress disorder, and so he's damaged after the war.
So he served in Iraq 3 times, is that right?
That's how I did it, yeah. I had him go 3 times.
Now, exercise is one of the things that brings these two people together, Skinner and Soleil. Why?
Yes. Well, I think that for Skinner, exercise is really about reliving the traumatic event where his friend dies and he can't help him, where his friend is wounded and he can't help him. He can't pick him up. He's wearing too much combat gear. People wear, as I understand, very heavy combat loads, and he's fatigued. He can't pick his friend up, and this gets tied up with his traumatic memory of the event of his friend being wounded. So he's obsessed with making himself strong. That's why he exercises. That's what's behind that. It's a reliving of that, and it's trying to get it right the second time. Now, for Soleil, exercise is something very different. She, for her, it probably has to do with just her busy feet. It goes back to a myth when she was a kid, the idea of being able to cover vast desert distances on her 2 feet.
This feels like a very physical book. Would you say so?
I would say so. I would hope so. I think that people I tried to ask myself, how do people process how is the audience going to process what I say? How do I read? And I began to notice that I read through physical things, things that maybe are in my mind because evolution put them there. I understand a tree, I understand a rock, I understand the sun. Those are basic ideas. They're like emoticons on your mental phone. You know what those things are. So I tried to stay with those things that you could touch.
Well, part of that physicality is the place. It is New York. So Soleil and Skinner meet and they're together in New York. How different is their New York from the one you're in right now as you speak to me?
Right now, I am on the, without giving away too many details of the location of the studio here for, you know, security reasons. One must always think of security. I'm on the Upper West Side. And the Upper West Side is not the outer boroughs. This book takes place in the outer boroughs, where Queens almost grades into Long Island. And she's going to be lost in industrial landscapes where there are highways, there are silos filled with gravel, where there are nothing but auto repairs, places like the Iron Triangle in Flushing where there are just miles and miles and sheds of sheds of places that do metalwork and auto repair and chop shops. So that's the New York where this takes place.
So it's not a romantic vision of New York. It's not even a sort of romantic, gritty New York. It's much harsher than that.
Well, I definitely sought to make to choose a gritty landscape. To me, I think it is a little romantic. I think it's the I think it affects me emotionally. It it's so ugly. It's grand sometimes.
Atticus, there's a distinct pace and even soundtrack to your novel. There are fragmented accents and action and an internal sort of pounding. But I can't quite describe that soundtrack. How would you describe it?
Well, I was influenced by rock and roll when I wrote the book. I said I want to make it feel like a rock song. I want it to have the same rhythm to it. I think one very strong influence, one thing that I specifically had in mind was Kid Rock's song Bawataba. I can never really pronounce the name of that, but it's I was thinking of trying to sing it and then I thought better of it, so let me not do that. But anyway, then after a while, you know, I figured out that I actually can't make the entire book sound like a pounding, driving rock song because we're all going to get exhausted, including me. So it's important to have variations in cadence. I was a beginning writer, and so I was figuring that out as I went. And later I learned to try to vary my tempo in order to give the reader a rest and to accentuate it when the pace had the when there was an uptick in the pace in the dramatic scenes later.
Part of that pace is that Zola runs. What does that mean to her, running?
I think running has a mystical significance both for her and for me. There's a connection to a myth that she's heard, a fairy tale that her mother told her. It's a kind of a Siberian shapeshifter myth where someone is running, walking, traversing giant distances, deserts after deserts, and this is a spirit quest. Like a dream, like a dream that you might go on if you're a shaman. And so running evokes that. But it also has something much more basic to it, which is her ability to escape. She has to be able to defend herself. She's a woman who any criminologist would say is a high-risk person. She has virtually nobody to protect her, and she's continually in situations where she could be made to disappear and nobody would look for her. She's someone without an identity. She's an attractive female. She's unprotected.
This running, though, it means that shoes and boots are a sort of motif in your novel. Are they part of the essentials?
Well, they became part of the essentials for certain because they're always getting worn out by that continual running, and they have various meanings. I think Zola would like to have certain creature comforts. She fetishizes a nice new pair of sneakers. The ones that she has are knockoff cheapo brands that she got from the closeout city, and they hurt her heels. I actually had a pair of sneakers like that when I came to New York. I got them for $20, and it was $20 poorly spent because there is a piece of plastic in the heel that ends up making them impossible to wear. They end up cutting your heel. So And then meanwhile, you have Skinner's boots, and his boots, as you learn right in the beginning, carry the mark of the gruesome mark of the war that he's been in. They have blood on them. So the shoes mean various things.
This thing's going to get out of hand here. We're going to need some backup.
On the mean streets of Britain.
I wondered if preparation for the next life had shades of Hugh Selby's last exit to Brooklyn, but with more Chinese and Hispanic voices in it.
You know, I read Hubert Selby's book while writing this, and I was very inspired by his style, by the very gritty feeling that he was able to get. His style may have been one of the things that I had to cast off so that I wasn't overly influenced by it, but he did leave a major impression on me.
Because Selby's Brooklyn has Irish unionists in it, and of course that's there in the second act of your novel when Jimmy Murphy comes in. Now, he thoroughly nasty character and really very scary. So scary he was hard to look at or think about. Is he dated? Is he from an older New York?
Well, that's a good question. When I saw my Jimmys, it was back in the early 90s, so maybe he is a little dated. And in this also, he's aware that his neighborhood is changing. So even if he is up to the present, it's a present that's disappearing right before his eyes. The demographics are altering. Right now, you can go to Flushing and you can see the neighborhoods where this is set, and they're being completely remodeled and revamped by primarily Asian immigrants, although it's still a highly, highly diverse area, maybe one of the most diverse areas in any city.
On the other hand, though, what Jimmy Murphy does is he feeds into that whole post 9/11 context that's shaping new forms of fear and prejudice in the city. How important was that for you as something to explore in your novel?
That was very important. That was part of the drive to write the book. You know, I mentioned three themes. One was the Iraq War, and the other was visiting China and coming to New York. When I say the Iraq War, what I really mean is my reaction to everything that happened with 9/11 and post 9/11 under George W. Bush. I was appalled, like a lot of Americans, but I felt like I was appalled alone. I didn't really know anybody else who didn't like what was happening. And so anyway, as the mainstream media got in line and as nobody really spoke up, I felt very alienated by my own country. And so that was why I wrote the book, really. And all of that is packed in there. And so Jimmy definitely relates to that theme in his bigotry.
Let's return to that story then, and to the love story. Zola and Skinner are both unlikely as a couple and so terribly well connected. Did they break your heart?
I did have a strong emotional reaction to what I put in the book. Yes, I actually did.
Atticus Lish's novel, Preparation for the Next Life, won the prestigious Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Not bad for a debut novel. It's published by One World. It was speaking there to Kate Evans. And if you're wondering about that distinctive surname, he is indeed the son of the famous editor Gordon Lish, who worked with Raymond Carver and others. But the two were estranged for years, and Atticus didn't ask his father to read the book. Well, that's it for Books and Arts. If you haven't done so already, why not make this the moment when you download the new ABC Radio app? It's free and it allows you to listen to this show or any other RN program on your smartphone at your leisure. Stay with RN. Big Ideas is coming up next, but tomorrow on Books and Arts, Jala Arts is an Aboriginal-owned and managed arts centre in the APY lands in the far northwest of South Australia. It's also home to many of Australia's highest profile visual artists. We speak to some of them. That's 10 a.m. here on Books and Arts. Thanks so much for your company here in the wee hours. If you're still awake, I'll catch you at 10 a.m. here on RN.